Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. I think I'll kick off this week with a reminder. If you enjoy the three times a week Realignment content we've been putting out, if you want to get access to bonus interviews and submit and hear answers to questions, you should go to realignment.supercast.com. That's how we monetize the show. Five a month, 50 a year, 500 for lifetime membership. As we're going into the 2022 midterms and obviously the year for the 2024 election, we want to make this show as great as possible. And the support from folks is incredibly helpful. And also, you know, the bonus stuff is great too. Today's episode is the definition of a conversation we want to have on The Realignment. Speaking of Anya Kamenetz, she is the author of The Stolen Year, How COVID Changed Children's Lives, and Where We Go Now. She reported on higher education and K-12 education at National Public Radio, which makes her the perfect person to have this conversation with. This is definitely controversial. There's definitely bits which I agree with, parts I disagree with, but I think this is a great first stab at history that we're going to have to be unpacking for a long time, given the generational effects of decisions that were made. So hope you all enjoy this conversation and see you next time. Anya Kamenetz, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to speak with you. I do a lot of episodes around a bunch of different topics. We're doing Taiwan this month. There's some coverage of post-Abe Japan, but I'd say this has definitely been one of the most difficult episodes I've had to try to put together, because this obviously on 15 different levels is a conversation where it's really difficult to have it both in good faith, but also push around parts that I think are going to make basically everybody uncomfortable in different ways. So I want to basically start with this question. You did a podcast appearance towards the start of the month, and you said that now is the perfect time to have an honest conversation about what happened to children during COVID. Because if we don't do it now, it's effectively going to be memory hold. The use of the phrase honest conversation suggests we haven't been having an honest conversation. So you start by just like reflecting on the conversational part of that here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, look, when schools closed all over the world in March 2020, the people in power knew, or they should have known, that it was going to have a detrimental impact if they stayed closed, really for more than a couple of weeks. We have, you know, it hasn't been forever, but since we started to have industrialized societies where there's compulsory universal education, stopping that is bad for kids. And because we make schools the hub of so many different kinds of services, that it is a major marker. You know things are going very, very badly in a country when schools close. It's a pandemic, it's a war, civil war, like the invasion of Ukraine, or it's a natural disaster like an earthquake in Pakistan. That's when the schools close. And so when that happens, kids lose this focus, this purpose, this meaning, this structure in their lives, and they oftentimes lose access to essential services. And the more poor kids you have in your country, whether you have a poor country or you have what we have in America, which is a rich country with a lot of poor kids, the harder that's going to be.
I'd love for you to expand a bit on the hub of social services point, because by way of my background, I went to a super zip public high school in Oregon. So, and I think that probably reflects most people who are in like our line of work. So when I think of school and I thought of the closures in March 2020, I thought, okay, well, it's going to shift to Zoom. You're going to learn, because that's the primary purpose of school. But my number one takeaway from your, even just your first few chapters, was like, holy crap, like this may be obvious to a bunch of people, but school was mostly way more than just insert X amounts of textbook knowledge. Talk about like the broad spectrum that folks like, frankly, me, just don't really think about that often.
Sure. So, I mean, I went through kind of Maslow's hierarchy of needs in the book. Like the federal school lunch program is the second largest public food program in the country. It serves billions of meals a year to 30 million children. There is a fluctuating number, but about, you know, in large cities like New York City, one in 10 children is unstably housed. Across the country, It's about 1 in 14 children that are unstably housed. So we've got a lot of kids that school is their place that is a safe place. A lot of neighborhoods where schools, you know, even though we talk about school shootings and we can get into that later, but schools are a very safe place. They don't have guns in them. So one thing that happened when schools shut down was there was a rising rate of gun injuries among children because there are more guns in family homes than there are in schools. So that's kind of those are the basic needs. And then you can talk about stability, right? Which is something that really did affect children. Didn't matter what their class background was. We had a mental health crisis in this country because school is the place of structure, purpose, meaning, and socialization for children. It's obvious if you think about it, right? They find caring adults and they find peers. Now, this is not true across the board. There are children who are bullied in school. There are children who are socially isolated. School can be a negative place and a stressful place. However, taking it away en masse, on balance, is really removing the point, the reason for being. And Zoom just was a very pale substitute for that for most kids.
And something I'm curious about, when you pointed out that after those first initial weeks, policymakers should have really understood the deep implications. I think you're perfectly suited to making that point because you actually wrote a piece in March 2020 saying just that. So like, that's why I want to have this conversation with you. Can you just take us back to that piece, frankly? Mm-hmm. What previous experiences or just like knowledge did you have as a then NPR reporter that made you think, wow, like one of these things, not like the other ones, when we're talking about closing grocery stores, well, not closing grocery stores, but closing businesses, closing gyms, movie theaters, et cetera. Because most people, and this was definitely the uncomfortable part for me, I was like, oh, I actually thought of all of these things as just one concurrent category of closed versus open. So take us back to March 2020 from your perspective.
Well, I think that's exactly right. We made a category error as to whether K-12 schools were an essential service or a non-essential service. Grocery stores, yes. Restaurants, no, right? Gyms, no. Clinics, yes. And yet somehow we got into a situation where we put schools on the wrong side of that line. So the piece you're talking about, I actually published in April 2nd, 2020. So it took
bad
me a couple
research.
Weeks. Well, just to not, you know, overstate the prescience, but there were two experiences that I'd had that fed into this. One was New Orleans is my hometown. So I had been down in New Orleans a couple of weeks after Katrina. I had visited and talked to kids who were displaced by the storm immediately, who were not in school. I'd been to the makeshift schools that sprang up to try to teach those kids. And then I'd been back 10 years later to talk about the research of what happened and how, even though most of those kids were back in school within a few weeks, and oftentimes those schools they returned to were better than the ones that they had left, it took 2 years for kids to get back on track. And then for high school students, it was a lot worse because when, you know, a high school student is at a transition moment in his or her life and they are thinking about their futures and they have competing pressures. And it is much more likely that a high school student's going to go into something else if school's not there. So they're going to go into paid work. They're going to go into caregiving work if they're a girl. They may go into street life depending on what the local culture is. And that is exactly what we saw in New Orleans. We saw high school graduation going down and college going down. And actually that perpetuated for 10 years, which is how could that be? In 2015, you know, the kids in Katrina, you know, they would have grown up by that time, but there was clearly a chain reaction that occurred, perhaps a change in the culture of the school and the society, where more and more kids drifted out of school. So this is a major kind of impact and reverberation just from this fairly short closure. And then the other strain of interest that I had was in global education, in education in emergencies, you know, thinking about what we've done in the last 15 years, which is get the first generations into school in places like in sub-Saharan Africa, in certain parts of India, you know, and it's this major global development goal because going from not school going to school going is this phase shift in terms of possibilities and dreams and equality and all these things. And so what happens when that turns off?
I almost wonder, because once again, like so much of the first chapter's revelations for me is like, look, despite, you know, a nation at risk in 1984, the, you know, No Child Left Behind discourse, which was like a real thing when I was like back in fourth grade in 2001. our schools actually really work. I guess that was like my takeaway. Like my takeaway is our schools actually really work, like at a core level. I'm curious what your, can you just basically like compare and contrast the, like, what was like the conventional wisdom amongst like discourse circles around like whether or not America's schools were effective relative to what we saw happened when those, let's say, not quite OECD, you know, ranking crushing schools were just taken away? Because that was just something I haven't quite come up with my mind as, but I'd love to hear what you think about that.
I love that question because I've been covering kind of the failure decline narrative in schools and in colleges for 20 years almost. And people love to hate on schools and they love to point all the ways they're falling short. And they're not wrong. The thing is that we live in a knowledge economy and our desire for great education is effectively infinite. Like, what do you not want to know about? What do you not want to have the opportunity to learn? And don't you want to be able to learn it in the most innovative, constructive, creative way possible? So we're comparing the job that schools are doing to the job in our minds, which is like always growing and always getting better. You know, schools should serve everyone. They should serve everyone equally. They should serve them in these all these different ways. And so the decline narrative has been an unbroken downhill run kind of since before the Constitution. Like, we've been saying that schools are failing all this time and they keep failing, but somehow they're kind of, it's like this optical illusion. They're failing upwards. Like, they're doing more and more stuff. And a lot of the stuff they're doing, I would say American schools globally are on the mediocre side to they're not horrible, especially, mm-hmm. I mean, we're spending fair amount of money. We're getting fair amount of results for the fair amount of money we're spending. What the problem is that is below the surface is that we have this incredibly unequal society and we have way too many kids that are have-nots. And so, as I try to explain in the first chapter, like, the more kids you have in a classroom who have traumatized experiences, who have these huge economic problems, who haven't eaten breakfast, right? Mm-hmm. How can school solve that?
And it seems to me, based on what you're articulating here, what I think the OECD decline narrative doesn't capture, and I think was become very apparent 2.5 years in, is that OECD rankings, that's reading, you know, that's yeah. math, it's science. It's not just the basic assessment of, oh, do these schools provide a safe space? Saying that unironically, obviously, yeah. Do they provide a safe space? Do they provide basic social services that in many contexts are just not provided about them? So that's an important thing to note. So the next mm-hmm. question comes to your point about how we made a category error when it came yeah. to schools being a essential versus non-essential service. It seems that everyone overestimated the ability of online substitutes to play into that. So I'm sure someone would say, no, we didn't make a category error because we kept them open. We yeah. got kids on Zoom instantly. Imagine yeah. how bad this would have been pre-internet. Imagine how bad this would have been with low bandwidth in the 2000s. So we made them essential, but it seems that what you are making the point here is that physical brick and mortar schooling in of itself is an essential service. Is that a good way to put it?
I think that's fair. I think that, there's a caveat to say that there are children who can learn online, and if they have the right resources, some even did better online. And the older the student is, the more likely that is a possibility. So, I, you know, it is very true that schools pivoted and changed their delivery for instruction, but it didn't. And so one of the heartbreaking things about this was there was so much effort put into that. And it was really very impressive, including getting tons of laptops out to kids, tons of hotspots out to kids. But it wasn't enough.
So here's the next question then. Who exactly made the category or error? And this is where the U.S. is an interesting country to look at, because once again, it's a decentralized, like locally centric school system. And obviously, you got a couple of dunks in on then Secretary of State Betsy DeVos. I am like not a Betsy DeVos fan, but I think a quick counter I'd give to you about her not giving proper guidance is I strongly suspect after 4 years, she did not have much credibility in the mm-hmm. spaces that were actually where these debates were actually, you know, intensely preparing. I'm trying to imagine being a teacher running in and saying, guys, like Betsy DeVos has given us the guidance, we can reopen. That yeah. wouldn't have been a winning argument. But that also speaks to the fact that Betsy DeVos, as Secretary of Education, could not just say, as in maybe Germany or the UK, we right. are reopening. So just right. talk about the I guess how the like decision process plays out in a country like ours.
Yeah, I think that's it's very smartly put. And you know, Betsy DeVos said last month in July 2022, I do not think the Department of Education should exist, right? So that's where she's coming from as far as leading that department. So I think there was obviously this huge vacuum of leadership, the incredible decentralization of our school system. Would it, you know, as a counterfactual, is there anyone who could have captained that ship and really rallied people around this very strong statement that schools must reopen and they will be reopened in these X ways? Possibly not, right? Possibly we just had too many strong people down at the local level who were going to tussle over it. So I think that's one very important point to make. Obviously, you know, you can't discount how badly we managed the pandemic per se, right? We had so many people dying that, you know, countries like New Zealand and Japan and South Korea didn't have this controversy because they weren't that afraid of the pandemic. They didn't have so many deaths that it was like unconscionable to open up. They opened right back up. It was no big deal. Like, we're just going to control the virus the way we've been controlling the virus. And then there were countries, that more resembled us, like Europe, where they went through waves, but they had a coherent process of determining what they were going to open and what they were going to close. And it just didn't seem like we did that here, because there were either places that opened everything up or there were places that were extremely cautious, specifically about schools and about children. But I'm dodging your question about who was to blame, right? Because I think there were competing interests, right?
Okay.
Because, you know, so unions do not represent teachers in every state. They represent teachers in a little over half of states. But unions represent teachers. They represent not students. So they represent the working conditions of teachers. And there was a serious equivocation over the question of whether the most important thing was the safety of the adults in the building or the well-being of the children in the building. And that played out in a variety of different ways.
I want you to talk a bit about the unions representing teachers ultimately and not students argument, because this is where this gets messy and interesting. Yeah. Because obviously Betsy DeVos, before she is Secretary of Education, she is not just a prominent, let's just say like libertarian minded, like school choice, philanthropist, donor, et cetera. But she also is leading groups like, you know, that frame themselves as, we are pro children.
Yes.
Because ultimately, to your point, they say, look, the teacher unions, and let's put aside the good faith thing or bad thing, there's just a rhetoric that's being utilized here. So how do you just personally like reflect on that rhetoric, and maybe how maybe the way the unions frame themselves was like well set up for a environment where the debates are about like possibly overhyped charter schools in New York City versus what actually happened during COVID-19?
Yeah. I mean, it's really, really hard. I spent a lot of time listening to all sides, right? That's like the NPR disease. So, and I own that. But I think that, you know, I would say that for teachers who working specifically in low-income schools with a lot of kids who need a lot of help, they see themselves as service workers. They see themselves as mission-driven. And they are, most of the time, when they are trying to improve their working conditions, they're also improving their students' learning conditions. Like, most of the time, they're not lying. That's one. They're very, very united. And this was a particular point where their interests tended to diverge. And I think one of the big problems was that the way that teachers talked about how reopening could be managed turned into a fight about mitigation practices. But the ultimate question was, who do you trust with the safety of your children? And trust was the main thing that was lacking here. And when you get into an adversarial process, trust goes right out the window. And the incentives on both sides were not helpful for the well-being of children. The incentives of leaders like mayors or district leaders was to say, everything's fine. We're doing everything we're supposed to be doing. And the incentives of teachers were to say, no, you're not. It's scary. And so when teachers did things like, in some places, march with cardboard images of children's coffins. Like, this is your kid's teacher. You trust your kid's teacher, and your kid's teacher is saying it's not safe. And so even when the schools open up, those kids don't go because they don't think it's safe. And we know that in public health, messaging and trust are the two most important things. What you do is really important, but how you talk about what you do is even more important. And so we missed the chance to have a really clear conversation about what we're trying, well, you know, the things that we had in common, which we did want kids back in school. I never met in person. I know there are some union leaders who made public statements, but I never met in person a teacher who said remote learning was fine. There's no such thing as learning loss. They saw the impact on their kids and it mm-hmm. hurt them, but they were not trusting the people that were supposed to keep them safe. And they communicated that mistrust to the parents.
So speaking of NPR disease, since you are no longer with NPR, I will force you, or at least attempt to get you to adjudicate between these two claims. So it seems like there were two claims at issue that you just referenced. So one, the teachers' unions, and then teachers, obviously, in some circumstances, making the claim that districts were not doing what they could to provide safety.
Yeah.
Where do you fall on, and once again, a country of 350 million people, that's very difficult, but like, I guess it's only half the country, really, if you think about it, given the, so like within the parts that we could evaluate, like how general could you, would you evaluate the accuracy of that teacher claim?
I think if you zoom way out, you cannot find a difference in death rates per capita by state compared to when they opened their schools. That's at a super high level, right? Or how much they opened their schools.
Oh, quick question. Is this pre or post vaccine?
Great question. So that would be over the first year.
Okay. First year. No difference.
Pre-vaccine.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Now that's a great question because there's a correlation between vaccine uptake and, the school opening approach, right? Most places that open up schools, unfortunately, had less vaccine uptake. However, teachers had a very high rate of vaccine uptake, even in red states. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to the extent that adult transmission is limiting spread, that was somewhat of a constant. So big picture, it's hard to see a difference. If you look across our peer countries and the mitigations that they did, they were building up a lot of confidence. And by fall 2020, it was pretty established confidence that we could limit transmission to an acceptable level with the right mitigations and by using data and testing. Acceptable is a huge question. Who's acceptable to who? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, having kids in school versus what X percentage of fewer cases, right? Is it different during a surge? Is it different if you have vaccinations? Whose lives are more important, right? That's like a horrible question to have to ask, but there is one paper that tried to quantify this. And unfortunately it had some major methodological issues, but if you think about it just in terms of what are we comparing, when kids don't graduate high school, they have lower lifespans. They don't live as long. They're not as healthy. Mm-hmm. So when schools are closed, kids are less likely to graduate high school. So when we close schools, you are making potentially a difference in terms of morbidity, mortality down the road. So in theory, it might be possible one day to make an apples to apples comparison, but in the moment, it was very hard.
I guess what I'm wondering then is like the next claim, and obviously you were giving like an anecdote of seeing a teacher with a children's coffin. So I'm not making the claim that like every teacher union leader was making that claim, but the way of answering that question is, to what degree were children at risk? And then would it have been fairer from a good faith perspective for the teacher to have a teacher's sized coffin in terms of, so like those are two questions, but the first question is how accurate was the child risk bit? And then secondly, if they were a little more good faith, cause I suspect I know what your answer is. If they'd been a teacher sized coffin, would that have been an accurate depiction of what the trade-offs were?
I mean, I think you and I both know that the death rate from COVID in children is very low. It's extremely low. But how do we look at that? I mean, children aren't supposed to die of anything. So, as low as it was still a top 10 risk, cause of death in the first 2020 pandemic year. So do we value the life of those children over all the children who didn't get to go to school? This is a massive question. This is a society-wide question. It's a question that needs to be brought up in an honest conversation. I'm glad that you're asking it. To the teacher point, there is some research from the UK that indicates no higher infection rate of teachers in the classroom compared to who you're going to compare them to, other essential workers or other laptop remote workers who didn't have to go anywhere, right? So compared to the broad population of both together, the teacher infection rate was no higher. So they're teaching in an environment where, yes, they're around other people, right? But the other people they're around are children, and children are slightly less likely to catch and spread the virus or be symptomatic. So they're in, and they're able to use mitigations. And I think the ability of a teacher to use mitigation, we could say, would be below a healthcare worker. Healthcare workers built a lot of confidence. We didn't hear a lot about healthcare worker infections, right, after the first flush of the virus, as long as they had the PPE that they needed. Nursing homes, yes. Nursing homes, there were problems with PPE, there were problems with exposure. But in healthcare, they were not as worried, right? They were worried about viral load because they're just seeing COVID patients all day. So that's one level. Now, people who work in a restaurant or in the service industry and they have no ability to get people that they're working with to wear masks, that was in another category. Teachers are somewhere in the middle. They can tell their people in their room with them to wear a mask. They have that authority if there's a mask mandate going on, right? And we're talking about first year pandemic. So there were not mass teacher deaths from COVID. There were not more teacher deaths from COVID than other essential, you know, they were not on par with other essential workers. They were below the death rate among teachers, controlling for their women, controlling for they're in their 40s and above, was not higher to my knowledge.
I think the next question I'd like to ask, and I really don't know where this is going to lead, because it's one of the dilemmas in that podcast I was referencing that you did at the start of the month earlier. Y'all were discussing the fact that, you know, in a weird way, like our response was the opposite to European countries, in the sense that like European countries, they're like schools first, businesses, gyms, other places second. Here in many localities, even ones which were not just like Florida instantaneously opened, you know, the gym, the movie theater was open before schools were. I'm curious why you think that happened. And I just want to preface this with a thought. I don't know if you're going to say this, but I was kind of thinking, is she going to say that that's capitalism? Like in America, it's a place where we say, you know, business comes first, like whatever happens to kid happens to kids. But the interesting thing that I noted is that a lot of the folks who would be most capitalistic in our system, so your most like Republican country club living person, I suspect they probably would be pro opening schools. So yeah. Like it doesn't like track, right? There's this like really like honestly like disgusting like anecdote you give where there's this elected official in Waukesha, Wisconsin, who was just saying, oh, you know, these school lunches are going to turn everyone into a bunch of like lazy socialists. Like, let's not worry about that. But the thing is, that's a example of like bad American capitalism thought. But I also suspect he probably would be in favor of opening schools full bore. Which is why like it's so confusing. So just like, what's your, that was kind of like a stem winder, but just like, what's your response to how weird this dynamic is?
I think a lot of people who found themselves feeling like they had gone through the looking glass, because a lot of people who thought of themselves as progressives, you know, ended up in the situation where they were justifying school closures and they were saying, you know, if you care about equity, you should keep schools closed. And then there are other people saying that's completely insane. Like keeping schools closed is bad for equity. It's bad for racial justice and equality and social equality and all these things that progressives say that they like. And I think part of the reason this is complicated is to say that like communities of color had a very different pandemic. They had higher death rates, higher infection rates. They were more likely to be essential workers, more likely to be in intergenerational community households. So they had higher risk, higher perception of risk, and higher actual risk. And so they were not supportive of school reopening, personally, because of their personal experience. Also because of what teachers in those schools in blue states often were telling them. They believed their teachers that it wasn't safe. And they also had a history of their local government and their schools not treating them well and not telling them the truth about things. So there's a mistrust, right? So there was a hesitancy, some people call it school hesitancy. And to the extent that the American progressive consensus is trying to uplift the voices of people on the margins, if you were doing that, you would be forced to say, okay, you know what? They don't want to go to school. because they don't believe that it's safe. And even, and so then you ended up with situations where schools reopened, but they had a remote option and the kids that needed the school the most were staying home.
I think what this brings to mind, another anecdote for the book, like you're discussing, you're following and discussing and profiling like different families going through the pandemic. And yeah. I was struck by severe vaccine hesitancy in some of like the Black families you were following. So it's just like interesting that on one hand, these communities are concerned about COVID to the point that this, you know, school reopening issue comes into play. But at the same time, there's vaccine hesitancy. So how are people squaring, like interpersonally, just like the families you were speaking to, but then even like city leaders. So for example, so like when you're talking about how the objective is to like elevate, you know, communities of color, well, there were vaccine mandates. I was in New York during the pandemic. There was a vaccine mandate. Grocery stores, all these different places. I was in favor of that mandate. I'm still in favor of that mandate. But that's a case where, and people, I think, in bad faith brought this up. People said, see, like, look at these progressives. They're hypocrites. They're just ramroding over, you know, low vaccination, you know, Black people. Yeah. But it's still attention. So just like talk about that, like societally and interpersonally.
Oh, it's such a tricky thing. I mean, I'll tell you, like, this didn't make it in the book, but I was in Oakland having coffee with a single mom who had kind of started working in her community, helping other family member, you know, other people, other families during the pandemic, and was part of this community group. And she just had finished telling me about losing one of her best friends to COVID, a woman that she felt like was a second mother to her. And in the middle of it, another man came up to us because we're on a sidewalk cafe and she's wearing a mask, right? We're both wearing masks out. This is spring 2021. This other man comes up and he's like, I just overheard you. And I said to tell you, I lost my mother to COVID. It was so sad. And they're having this conversation. These are two Black people. And then the mother I'm talking to is like, and I'm not vaccinated. And my children are not going to be vaccinated. And the other guy was like, oh no, I'm not getting vaccinated either. And it's like, I take COVID very seriously. I've seen it impact people very close to me. And I don't believe and I don't trust. And I don't think that they really are going to do the things they say they're going to do. And I don't think healthcare has ever helped. This is a woman who had a job in healthcare too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, what can I tell you? People are complicated and we have a severe lack of social trust among different groups in our society. And I think it's for good reasons.
I'm just going to ask you this question because I'm like very curious about it because you're obviously speaking with people on the ground. When we're talking about like the Black community's like lack of trust in the medical system, the way this is communicated anecdotally through Twitter, like let's say is like, look at the Tuskegee experiment. Like obviously like Black people are going to be skeptical, but I've always kind of wondered, I'm like, how many like Black people actually like know about the Tuskegee experiments? Do you kind of know what I'm saying? So is medical distrust in like the Black community is it kind of just like a vibe or is it like very specific?
So I'll cite research and also my own reporting to say that it is something that's reinforced every time people interact with the healthcare system.
Okay.
From not being able to find a doctor that you don't have, you know, to being relegated to the lowest tier of service because you don't have the right kind of health insurance, to being talked down to, disrespected, not offered the same care as other people, not offered help for your pain, being treated as a drug seeker if you go for pain. The social determinants of health, right, which I talk about in the book, like it's the food deserts, it's the it's the lack of time to exercise and things where people end up carrying a higher chronic illness burden. So I have Black family and friends who have diabetes, who have amputations, who have early cancers. And so when you interact with the healthcare system with that kind of disease burden, those are stereotyped as lifestyle illnesses. And it's seen as like inherently you're lazy. You don't take good care of yourself. You're irresponsible. So it's a whole thing. It's a whole ball of wax. We didn't even talk about maternal morbidity, mortality, right? No. What happens to women when they go in to have a baby? So yeah, I don't think it's Tuskegee.
Yeah. And the thing that's interesting, everything I'm hearing from what you're describing is, and this is why it's an honest conversation and it's not like a winners and losers and like bad guys and good guys bit here because it's complicated. Like it seems to me that like Black anti-vax is very different than white anti-vax.
Uh-huh.
In terms of I suspect that like the let's take white people from like the same social class as like the Black people you were talking to. I suspect that the anti-vax feelings are not like coming from bad interactions with like the US, like maybe with your health insurance company, but that's like kind of a little different than like your specific interactions in an emergency room or something like that. So that's just like an interesting note of the complicated part here. So to kind of take this back to the start of the episode. So you're writing that piece on April 2nd, to be precise. Mm-hmm. At what point did policymakers, leaders, community members, stakeholders, whatever, know enough to take a different path than we took? Because I think my feeling of COVID, being a decently informed like think tank person in DC, was, man, this is crazy. This is crazy. Like, we don't know anything. And I still think we should really, my answer is basically through the summer, I'm incredibly sympathetic to basically any poor choice folks made.
Yeah.
Separate from like Trump sending some tweets, but put Trump tweets aside, very sympathetic. When is your answer to like, what was the statute of limitations basically when it came to who could know anything? Let's make tough choices.
Well, look, there's a lot of different components to leadership. And there's vision setting, and then there's logistics operations, right? So having a very strong goal of getting kids back in school and stating that goal repeatedly was something that people started to do in the summer of 2020, but it wasn't everywhere and it wasn't reinforced. And there were some real missteps, I think, in that area because I kind of call out a little bit of a back and forth where the American Academy of Pediatrics tried to put a stake in the ground in saying, we must start with a goal of putting children in school, you know, and then that was like celebrated. They were, you know, invited to the White House, the authors of the paper, or the head of the AAP was invited to the White House, but it's the Trump White House. And so then there's a backlash and the teacher union is like, well, you never talked about our safety. You just talked about kids. And then they issue new guidance, you know, very shortly thereafter and really soft pedal it and walk it back. So, so the vision setting, I think people should have done it in the summer. There's some forgotten incidents. I mean, I talk about how the governor of California in the summer of 2020 was like, maybe we'll open up for summer school. And the teachers unions and the state authorities were like, oh, no. And they stayed open. They stayed closed for like pretty much longer than anyone else. The second part, though, is the logistics, right? And you need money and you need information. And schools are a very complicated system. So they pivoted everything they did in spring of 2020. April is when school districts start planning for the following year. They start planning their scheduling, their staffing, and everything they're going to do. But they're not doing that. They're running remote learning and they're giving out sandwiches in parking lots. And they're trying to triage emotional health and well-being. So they're doing like a whole bunch of other stuff and they're limping to the end of the year. And then it's the summer and cases are going a little bit down. And you know, we thought it was going to be 2 weeks to flatten the curve. This doesn't really look like that's what's happening. Nobody really knows what it's going to look like in September. So let alone, and the guidelines that were improvised in some places that kept kids in congregate settings had not yet been reinforced and issued. It was very, very cautious on the public health authority level. So they didn't necessarily have the information, nor did they necessarily have the resources to do that. So I fault them for not setting the vision up. I don't necessarily fault them for not having all the pieces in place in fall 2020. But we know and we saw that the later you started, the harder it was.
So it seems to me the ideal version of Gavin Newsom to moderate the statement he gave, could have said, our goal is to get children back in schools because that is just of paramount importance with the requisite. But to your point, right, like you said this towards the start of the episode, there is usually a correlation between good teacher working conditions and student achievement. So always these things shouldn't be thought of separately, right? If teachers are out sick every other day, if they are fearful for their literal well-being, I suspect that they would not have been effective in terms of giving the benefits of actual in-person schooling. So the vision point is really well taken. Something I want to ask then is, what lessons should we take from basically the other extreme of basically red states that just opened everything up? Mm-hmm. So we talked about like the morbidity, but separate from that, we ran it, and this was part of the critique, right? Like they're running an experiment of children and teachers' lives. Like, and I don't want to talk about people's lives this way, but like, what did the experiment demonstrate for us in that year?
I definitely talked to teachers who felt traumatized by being forced to go to school when they considered it to be unsafe, particularly if they had pre-existing conditions, particularly if they had vulnerable family members at home. I talked to teachers who showered every day before they came in the house, to, you know, to change their clothes, were really scared of their kids getting sick. Teachers that hid behind a shower curtain in their classroom to try to make themselves healthier, like a clear plastic shower curtain. So that part was messy. That was scary. There are some various informal, and again, this is frustrating. We don't have the data we'd like to have. Various informal attempts to track teacher deaths from COVID. And anecdotally, what I can tell you is that unvaccinated teachers in Florida died a lot. I saw that happening. I saw those numbers coming through. Did they die more than other unvaccinated people of the same age group? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But certainly people died because of a lack of precautions and a lack of restrictions.
I guess the next question would be, from your perspective, there's this obvious point that, you know, we're going to just continue to see not just variants, right? Let's put the variants to the side, but there just are going to be serious, like, respiratory diseases, globalization, travel, all those different bits, right? Like, this has been increasing in frequency over the past few decades. What would be your just, like, not even number one, but just top few blanket recommendations to make sure that this never happens again? And by this, I mean this kind of wishy-washy, just really strange process. Because there could have, and once again, I don't want to, like, speak lightly of this, because, like, I had the benefit of not having family members die of COVID, but there is a world where more people had died, but you could still be confident in the process that got us to that point.
Yeah.
It seems like the real story to take away from my takeaway is, like, man, like, considering how much of a shit show this was.
Yeah.
In this context with children's schools, et cetera, we got lucky that this wasn't a bigger disaster.
I agree. I mean, from the point of view of the disease, I mean, we have the highest death rate in the developed world from COVID. We lost so many people. And, like, so it's like, and then we have kids, average elementary school kid, latest test score analysis. It's going to take 3 years for the average elementary school kid to catch up, and much longer for middle school kids. We don't even see progress in the past year for middle school kids, because let's not forget, we had a continuation of interruptions from quarantine, from Omicron, right? From kids having to stay home for 10 days over this last year. So this was not, we're not in recovery yet. What I would hope that we would take forward would be just a really clear understanding from the get-go of all the jobs that schools do, and then maybe give them less jobs to do, you know? Like, if we fed kids and we had a child tax credit and we cut child poverty in half, we wouldn't have so many kids who were, their lives were at risk when they stayed home. Like, that's not what we should have in this country.
Yeah. And kind of this speaks to, I think, kind of like the first third of your book, where you're really just pointing out that in a society that has chosen the level of welfare state we have, like, we've outsourced a lot of roles to schools. And the question is, as you recount with the legislative history of this, this happened very, like, piecemeal, like, over time. Like, this wasn't as if, like, there never was a moment where we said, like, you know what, like, we're going to be skeptical of this, 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 or that, but we're going to put this all into schooling. It happens over that. And the history you retell is very interesting. I think my next question then would be, okay, so this is actually helpful. We're not going to go back to March, April, June, May, 2020. That's not the choice that anyone has now. And now this is pretty straightforward to say, but moving forward, what policymakers actually have to figure out is, like, what do we do with those kids that were left behind? So what task do they actively have to work on moving now? Should people be held back more? I know that was a difficult conversation that, like, you mentioned in the book. Like, what do you see that as?
I think there's some good news here. Because first of all, there is some good news from the Katrina example that schools adapted their learning, their approach to teaching, and they were more the big picture of what you try to do is you don't make kids repeat information because kids get bored and they get disengaged. What you need to do is you kind of spiral the curriculum around where you make sure the fundamentals are covered while you're still continuing to cover new ground. And you also have to knit back together the emotional relationship with school, which has to do with, you know, bringing back the things that kids love about school, the extracurriculars, the art, the sports. These are the things that bring kids part of a community and get them to see a meaning and a point. And plus, for older kids, what they really want to see is a connection to their futures. So one of the interesting parts of this pandemic, and I cover it in a couple of the kids that I followed, the kids start working more, right? It's a huge labor shortage. They're not allowed to go to school. They start doing paid work. A lot of them found meaning and purpose and a way to get out of the house from paid work. So there are examples out there of alternative school programs that connect you more carefully with a job and a career. And so basically all of the things that make school better and that would make us better on that OECD measurement, but also in a future ready way, are going to be good for kids. More mental health, social emotional learning, more relevant, innovative curriculum that is more customized and specific to each kid as they go through. And of course, we need to also reinvigorate teaching and get the teachers, you know, out of the burnout, and we need to hire a lot more teachers. So there's a lot of work to do.
So in these last few minutes, I want to actually get to your broader body of work, because that's obviously one that really synced with a set of policy decisions and outcomes during the pandemic. So you've written about efforts to reform higher education. You've written about, you know, like your first book is about debt at a generational level. I'm curious how you think about the Biden administration's like upcoming decision around continuing the student loan payment pause. And those different bits. How are you thinking about that? And how do you recommend people think about that specific decision?
I think about it in terms of the social change movement work of people who successfully kind of pushed to make this a middle class agenda item as it is. I mean, what that is it's aid for the middle class to be able to build wealth and build stability. And it is also, there's a racial justice component because of the differential in borrowing across race, right? So there's some really good things about that policy. But first and foremost, what I see it as is an example of organizing works. And it takes a lot of time because when I published Generation Debt in 2006, people didn't talk about student debt. They didn't take it they didn't take it seriously. They thought it was like only a privileged kid's problem. And then we had Occupy, we had the financial crisis, we had all these other things. And now all of a sudden, it's a normal thing for a middle of the road Democratic politician to do. So I would love to see that kind of progress happen for children.
Do you think the student debt issue is a, like, you know, because once again, if we're actually looking at the implementation of like school lunches, say, like there's this debate about like directed aid versus like universal aid. Like, do you think student debt forgiveness is a universal question? Because once again, this gets hung up with, okay, well, what about the JD who took on a bunch of, you know, debt, whether they're poor or not? Like that's definitely going to be worth it. You'd likely in an individual example, how do you think of like the specific forgiveness versus universalist focus?
So I think that you can do the math and show that it's not a means-tested program if you forgive student debt, because on a very basic level, people without a college degree are not as economically well off as people with a college degree. The people that are worst off are the people that have some college and no degree and student debt, right? They don't have the earning potential of the people that got their degree. So you can do the math and you can argue it that way, but I still think that the people who want student debt forgiveness have a little bit more of the moral high ground, because what kind of society are we trying to build? Are we trying to build a society that rewards effort and achievement? Or are we trying to build a society where you overcome all these obstacles and you go and get that college degree and you still have something that is going to stop you from starting a business or buying a home or maybe even living on your own? So I think that's the same kinds of questions that we end up asking. We're kind of asking the wrong question when we say, well, oh, is it totally fair? Because some people might get an advantage out of it. Well, the whole point is to make give everyone an advantage. That's the point.
Something I'm curious about is, you know, broader debt, right? So not just student loan debt. Like there's a lot of discourse around, like, when you combine like the stimulus checks with the fact that people just like were not going out, like actually like people paid off a lot of credit card debt, all those different bits. There's been a huge bounce back of that, obviously. Could you just speak, and once again, this hasn't been like your focus as much like the past 2 years. I don't expect a perfect analytical answer, but like, what would you say like the generational debt story has been the past 2 years? Because the issue started being addressed and then we just totally snapped back. And those are the categories I'm personally just obsessed with. I'm obsessed with like, we started to do this thing. It was trending in the right direction. You could have written like a hopeful, like follow-up op-ed like in January, 2021.
Yeah.
And it just snapped back and it's worse. Like, how do you like, what, how would you like tell that story or think about that?
Oh, it's so frustrating. I was literally holding my book open and not submitting the manuscript because I was waiting to see what would happen with Build Back Better. Because it had this whole program of benefits for children and basically the whole thing that advocates have been asking for generations, and then it's gone, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess the optimistic idea is now that this stuff is on the agenda, you can't really unsee it. You can't unsee what you've seen. And this kind of returns us back to the beginning of the conversation because, you know, but the impetus is very strong to try to memory hole this. And there have been many points in our history where we did come very close to setting a new economic agenda. You know, for example, FDR had kind of like a second half of the New Deal that never really got to be proposed. There were a lot of people who wanted to extend the war on poverty and make, you know, even more benefits for the middle class, including childcare benefits. That never happened. So we have done this before. We have put out the football and Charlie Brown is kicked and we pulled it back. So kind of depends how you look at this country.
Yeah.
What you think the meaning of all that is.
Another thing would be, you know, I'm thinking of your DIYU book from a few years back. Obviously Scott Galloway had his big like college is doomed piece.
Yes.
Which you could make jokes about Scott. He's coming on the show in a few weeks, but I think he framed the argument very aggressively in a useful way of saying like, this is just, if it's, you know, summer 2020, this is the disruption that's going to basically break the status quo in the higher education system. And this is another case where that basically did not happen. The incumbents are still as strong. The prices did not decrease. How do you think about that happening when it seems like all of the tools to break that status quo were really there? You had like, you literally had a deus ex machina of this like pandemic. And then you had the technology and the tools. Why didn't that status quo get disrupted in your thinking?
I mean, I've seen a lot of people predict the demise of higher education and most of them are gone now.
Should that be the blanket advice for thinking about this topic for the next 50 years?
I just will point out that the higher education institutions that are the most venerable in this country are older than the United States, right? And I have a feeling that they're going to be here in some form even after the United States are gone. I mean, just look at their financial situation. Just look at Harvard's endowment, right? Like, it is going to be here. Does that mean that the average person's experience of their need for training, socialization, and networks is going to be identical now to what it was, it's, you know, in 20 years from now? No, it's obviously different than it was 20 years ago. YouTube is one of the biggest unsung revolutions in learning. I talked about it in DIYU. I still believe it's true. Access to knowledge, we've learned, is different from access to credentialing. It's different from access to networks and opportunities. But I think that this, kind of going back to a point I made before, in a knowledge economy and society, the appetite for knowledge and learning and information is effectively infinite, which means there is a continuously growing field of opportunity for, and in that field of opportunity, the incumbents can remain and even get fat. And then only some of the weakest get picked off the edge of the herd. And then all these new life forms keep perpetuating and evolving while the incumbents remain where they are. And that's kind of where I see it, at least until the climate crisis kind of weakens the infrastructure of complex society, which is a whole other conversation.
So we'll wrap with this question. My real takeaway is that from what can we learn moving forward? Obviously, Donald Trump is clearly not finished. He could be president again. And if we're looking at what happened in fall 2020, spring 2020 to fall 2020.
Yeah.
I know whataboutism isn't like fashionable, but it seems like you had two things happen. So like Donald Trump does everything he can to polarize every issue because that's his strategy. And then I think you have local teachers unions and like blue state actors almost define themselves against Trump too much.
Yeah.
That's clearly what happened here. How, if we live in a, like, And by the way, I think if this were President Ron DeSantis in 2025 and there's COVID 20 or whatever, you could see that dynamic replicating itself, not quite with the same valence, but directionally something there. What would be your advice for both sides to avoid that polarization dynamic, which is what basically toxically infects everything if you don't manage it properly?
Wow, that's a really big question. I mean, what I would hope, what I actually did see happening in many places at a local level was that people, when forced to make decisions together, were able to come to agreements. And despite everything that's happened, there's been a lot of changes in how Americans view their schools, their school system, and which party is more equipped to handle education, right? And there's been a lot of polarization over culture war issues as they pertain to the classroom. However, individual families' views of their individual children's public schools, we did a poll on this in April for NPR, and most families think that their kids' schools and their kids' teachers did a pretty good job, all things considered. So those face-to-face relationships with the school board, with the PTA, you know, the mundane aspects of trying to figure out how to buy new masks for the teachers or, you know, what to do about the book fair. Those are the things that are going to knit us together and to keep us going, I think, without the polarization that breaks everything down or in spite of it.
That's the weird, you could critique the, you know, decentralized nature of our system, but, you know, one of the good parts of it, it gives room for that. For that opportunity, not everything comes down to whatever Betsy DeVos thinks. This has been really great. Like, thank you so much. Could you do the useful thing of just shouting out the book's title? Specifically, it's available in our bookshop, and I'm sure wherever else anyone purchases books, we always appreciate the commissions there. So, what's the book?
Thank you so much. Yeah, my book is The Stolen Year: How COVID Changed Children's Lives and Where We Go Now.
Thank you for joining us on The Realignment.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really fun.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the show's mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.